Hi, this is Glenn Mulcahy. Welcome to Love What You Play podcast. Today we'll be featuring an interview from our Youth Leadership Online event that we originally hosted in December of 2018. The full event is available online on our website for loveofthegame.ca. Our mission is to help organizations, coaches, sports leaders develop programs so kids love the game more at the end of the season than they did at the beginning. We'd love to hear any feedback or comments down below, and please share this to others in your space so that we can all work together to bring the game back to the kids, because that's where it belongs. Hope you enjoy the chat and you get some great nuggets. Thank you. Hi, this is Glenn Mulcahy, your host for Love What You Play, online events and podcasts. Today I'm doing a round two with a good friend of mine in the UK, Gordon McClelland. He is the CEO and founder of Working With Parents in Sport, which was founded, and their mission is to support parents and coaches to work together to provide children the best quality sports experience possible. He's been a teacher for over 20 years, last 10 years as a director of sport for a prep school in the UK. He's taught also in New Zealand, and he has a BA in honors in sports science from University College Chester. And you, Gordon, you have to kind of tell me, what is a PGCE from Lanchester University?
Yeah, that's just your teaching qualification over here, so a qualified teacher.
Gotcha. So kind of the extra year that we have to do here. Yeah. And then as a result of what he saw firsthand as a parent of two kids in the youth sports, their early sports experience, he founded Working With Parents in Sport to kind of bring the game back to the kids, similar to why we're doing what we're doing, working with coaches and parents in Canada. So I'm really looking forward to round two. Let's go. Let's get at it, Gordon.
Yeah, great to be back.
So a lot has happened for you since we chatted last year. Maybe if you can give us a kind of an executive summary of how things evolved and why they're evolving so fast for you.
Yeah, I think we've been very lucky. I think with setting up any organization, I think everyone will be aware that it takes time. But we have grown sort of hugely in the last 12 months. I think we're now up to seven national governing bodies that are working alongside us. We're working with some clubs and schools of different sizes. We're working with the Little Athletics franchise in Australia. And then more recently, which is, I guess, exciting in your neck of the woods, is we're now doing some work with Soccer Nova Scotia, and we're also doing some work with Maryland State Soccer. So really exciting that it's not just a UK-based product, and we're able to try and sort of move it around the world in the best form that we possibly can.
And what is the, you've kind of tweaked the offerings you have. It started off with the original pocketbooks, then you revamped them. What other things are you doing that's been added to the wheelhouse since last year?
Yeah, I think we've just made it a far more, rounded product. And I think, as Matt Young often says to you, is actually provided more of those jigsaw pieces that people can put together. So yeah, we've got resources for parents and coaches that can be customized by organizations. We've enhanced the website experience, where we can now customize our website for organizations, and they're able to add some of their own content that's relevant for them. And we've also extended our workshop offering now. We now deliver four workshops. One for parents of children between 5 and 11, one for parents of children 12 to 18, maybe involved in pathway or performance programs. We're doing work with clubs on how they can effectively engage parents, so management of clubs and organizations. And then actually our most popular one to date is the coach education piece on how coaches can build positive relationships with parents. And we're talking at the UK Coaching Conference next week with that workshop. And a number of the sports that we work with are looking to write that into formal, coaching qualifications, as well as just continued professional development. So that's really exciting that people have recognised the need to add that to qualifications to, as you say, to help improve children's experiences.
Yeah, I mean, the last one you kind of touched on, and I get asked all the time, which is why I'm so excited that we're having this dialogue, is coaches will come to me and they'll say, you know, I just don't know how to deal with parents. Do you get that conversation? And then how do you shift it to the importance of engaging them?
Yeah, well, I think you've sort of half done it yourself, haven't you? I think the moment you hear a coach say, you know, how do I deal with them? I think you know that you've got to try and shift, you know, coach perspective, because, you know, we shouldn't really be dealing with them. You know, if we've been proactive in what we're selling and the product that we're selling and how we, you know, set up the environments around our groups, and we're looking to bring parents more into the process. But, you know, I think there's more of a fear, Glenn, when you talk to coaches, that they fear that just by letting parents in that it's going to be absolute chaos. I think there's a fear that coaches feel that if they allow a parent some 30 seconds worth of airtime, that it's then going to turn into 2 hours of airtime about little Johnny, which can happen. But I think if we've set our stall out and we've done far more to explain what the sporting journey may look like or what that season may look like and how we can best support each other so that everybody's singing from the same hymn sheet, I think we've got a far better chance of having better relationships.
So without giving away the farm, so to speak, what are some of the tips for those coaches so they can engage parents?
Yeah, look, I think for me, one of the biggest investments is the parents meeting at the beginning of the year. I know you and I talk a lot about it. I think we've just got to be careful when we're doing those parents meetings, however, that they aren't set up from a coach perspective all the time, so that we basically sit parents down, we label them, we tell them that they're naughty, we show off our sports science acumen as coaches, try and confuse them and tell them what we know. I think we've got to obviously get across some of the points that we've got to make about, you know, culture, philosophy, how training's going to look, what the match day experience is going to look like. But actually, we need to support and engage parents and almost coach them a little bit into the types of behavior that we would like to see from them. Because without that, we've got an awful lot of parents involved in the sporting experience who are merely mimicking their own experience that they maybe had as a child, or mimicking how they perceive that they should behave, or, you know, just following the group that's in front of them. And I think there's a responsibility for coaches there to try and set that tone and set that in environment. And, you know, I see lots of coaches working in little pockets of specific groups, you know, around the world, who have absolutely no issue with parents whatsoever. You know, everybody's sort of buying into the same thing. They all know which direction they're traveling in together, and it's very harmonious.
Yeah, and then that kind of precursors that, and I don't know if this is a conversation we want to do at length, but have you seen the video with the 7-year-old baseball team in Colorado?
No, I don't think I have yet.
You haven't seen it?
No, I don't think so.
I thought it officially had gone viral worldwide. I think it was 2 weeks ago. And almost everybody in the space that I've come across in Facebook pages, they're all sharing it in one perspective or another, where there was a bench clearing brawl because the umpire supposedly made a bad call. And then the parents just hit the field. What's your take, if you haven't seen the actual video, but what do you think?
Now you mention it, I have seen it. I thought you were going to show me, I thought I'd missed a video of the most harmonious environment around a 7-year-old game there. Yes, I have seen that one.
What's your take on it?
There's two things. I mean, one, I just can't believe it happens. I mean, just from somebody who's been involved in sport all their life, I just find it absolutely staggering that we've got people that stressed at that stage. Secondly, I guess, look, the sharing of those things is, again, just highlighting something that is bad in places, but it's not all bad. There's an awful lot of good things going on out there. And I always feel that when we show those, I feel like we're maybe just sticking the boot in again and highlighting parents as a problem. And yes, it's unacceptable. But actually, if people are going to show videos like that, I think they do have to be trying to show some solutions as well. It's very easy to say, well, you know, that's a poor car journey home, or that behaviour is unacceptable, and look at that woman who's shouting too much on the side of the field. But, you know, until we've actually tried to do something in a positive way that maybe explains to them that maybe isn't the best way of going about it, then I think we've just got to be careful how we promote media like that.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. Like early on when I was going down this path, I was focusing a lot on the negativity because that's why I got into it to begin with. But the other side of the coin is, and you're absolutely right, there's so many people doing so many great things that they're not being highlighted. They're not being focused on because the negativity is kind of overramped it. But my belief is that whole issue could have been completely avoided if they didn't have organized baseball for 7-year-old kids. If you look at Norway, where they're not technically competing until they're 13, maybe one of the solutions, I believe, is could we push the competitiveness aspect with the scoreboard, the timekeepers, and what have you, until later age groups, so that it does ease that pressure. And because it's a bottleneck, right? The parents are exploding. You know, they're worried about wins and losses. So is that one of the solutions?
Yeah, look, and that's really radical. I've always tried to go down the line, and even with my own children, you know, that winning can be important, and actually competing can be, you know, important. But it's where we frame the winning and competition bit. You know, in those situations, the winning and the competition has become the absolute be-all and end-all. And actually, you know, there should be winners and there should be losers, and we should learn how to compete. But this is the big thing for me. This is a 7-year-old sports game. Mm-hmm. You know, irrelevant of anything we're talking about, how on earth can a 7-year-old sports game be that important? Because the last time I looked, there wasn't an under-9 World Cup. And I don't remember an under-9 World Series ever happening. And the more I look into this, and the more I look at the fact that when we're good at 9, we're not going to be good at 18, actually makes me think even more, oh, hang on a minute, what are we actually thinking here? And have we painted this picture? Because in this rush for these parents to have the best teams and the best players at the age of 9, the sad thing is, we should be giving them a big cuddle and saying, do you know what, I'm really sorry, because it's not going to be like this 5 years from now. Mm-hmm. Because that's the reality of it. And I would rather go down that line that hang on, let's just all keep a sense of perspective here, realise what that sporting journey looks like for any player, enjoy competing, enjoy winning, but just frame it in a very different way.
Yeah, and one of the things that USA Hockey did, and I shared this out with a lot of people, as I talked to both Bob Mancini last event and Ken Martell, they were experiencing a really high rate of attrition by their age, peewee age group. So 11, 12 years old, they're losing 60% of their kids for a myriad of reasons. And one of the things that they did is they eliminated their U12 national championship. So it eased the pressure on the parents, the coaches, the players, to get to that pipeline. And as a result, they're now seeing 92% retention at that age group. So they're still losing 8%, but nowhere near what they had before.
And that's brilliant, isn't it? And actually, organizations need to take a really big look at this, because it's that in lots of cases, we often blame the parents. But actually, in a lot of cases, the structures that we set up actually do nothing to help parents whatsoever. So, you know, we talk about this in the UK, don't we? That if we're giving out 9-year-old football contracts, you know, at the age of 9, those years leading up to the award of those contracts are going to be pretty feisty on the side of pitches, because everybody's chasing that goal. And it's encouraging to see that, you know, I think England Rugby this year have removed some of their county cup competitions at under 13. I think people push those pathway programs back again, you know, maybe until those early teenage years. And as you say, the removal of those is brilliant, because parents don't feel under pressure to get the children selected, yet you're still able to win and compete, you know, during those years, which is important. And it's great to see, as you say, US Hockey are doing some great work in that respect about bringing the game back to children.
Yeah, it was pretty amazing. I was at I got a ticket for the NHL draft, so I got to see it live on Friday. And watching all of those U.S. national team players get drafted, like there was I think 8 in the first round, 17 total. Almost an entire team were drafted into the NHL. So it is a development pathway that is helping. But again, those kids don't get into that pathway till like 15 years old. So they're still working on their grassroots, the ADM model, what have you. So it's kind of a great hybrid model to take their path to excellence. It's pretty amazing. So
yeah, look, some of the sports I work with, you know, some swimming organizations and even badminton, you know, are beginning to recognize that how they sell and dress up their product and what it actually looks like is not doing any favors for anybody. It's not doing any favors for the parents who are committing huge amounts of time, who then suddenly expect selection and are then massively upset that their investment in time has led to nothing. There were far better ways of setting up the experience. And the one surprising one we had with badminton, over here in some youth badminton competitions, the parents sit at the back of the court like they do at the Olympics. I don't know whether you've watched Olympic badminton, but literally like the coaches sat at the back of the court, parents are allowed to sit there. And, you know, we're trying to create these independent players and these children who can be self-reliant and self-organized. And we've put parents who have got no sports experience whatsoever within 10 meters of their child. And then when you talk to the parents, they actually hate being there. We had a we had a conversation where we were saying, well, do you like it? Oh, no, not really. So what do you do when you're there? Well, I just try to make it look like I'm supporting my child properly. And then, of course, if somebody's on the court next to them and they're heavily involved, as a parent with no experience, that what we certainly don't want to be judged on is that somebody's a better parent than we are. So then, of course, we change our behaviours to show our love and our support for our children. So it was fascinating. And I went back to the badminton organisation and said, look, can we have a look at this? I said, because I'm not really sure why we need to have them at the back of the court at under 10 and under 11 and under 12. And it's like, well, yeah, I'm not really sure why we do that either. But it's again, it goes back to, you know, unless we have these conversations and we actually look at the whole picture and what it means to every party, and often parents have been left out of this piece, it's going to be difficult because we just carry on doing what we've always done, which in this space hasn't been particularly effective.
Yeah, and when we're doing everything, you know, the same thing over and over again, expecting different results, it's insanity, right?
Yeah.
So it's a matter of shifting the needle in a different direction. That the whole premise between that overcompetitiveness with the younger age groups, a perfect example of a positive that I had an opportunity to witness firsthand. There's a community-based organization that promotes multi-sport participation in Vancouver area only. They're hoping to expand the model in various provinces across Canada. They're called More Sports. And I went to see their soccer jamboree, and this was kind of amazing. I have to share it. I show up, and their K-1 kids were just kind of coming off the field. And I'm like, wow, there's a lot of kids here. They had two full-size soccer pitches, all-weather pitches, but they converted them by bringing in a whole bunch of mini nets and mini balls. They had 16 mini games going on at the same time, like 16. Yeah. That was unbelievable. They didn't have officials. They had leaders / volunteer coaches that really what they were doing was chasing the ball when it got kicked out of these small pitches. There was no trophies. There was no ribbons. It was just kids playing for the sake of playing. And what was really cool is they played like 3 20-minute games for the little kids. And then as the older age groups, they played 3 30-minute games back to back with a 5-minute hydration break. So physically they were moving for anywhere between 60 minutes to 90 minutes. And from a true concept, watching the parents, all they did was sit there, take some pictures, maybe an odd clap, but there was no expectations because there was no result.
Yeah.
And that's one of the big challenges. So for me, it was the epitome of organized free play, like it was when we all grew up. Yeah. How do we get more organizations to consider doing that type of model with the earlier age groups so it takes away that pressure for the parents?
Well, look, it needs effective leadership, doesn't it? And it needs leadership and management from the top. And then, you know, a lot of the work we focus on is about aligning, you know, your club culture to your coach behavior through to your parents and through to the athlete. So, we need leadership from clubs about, you know, what it looks like, what's important to that club, what's its culture. The coaches then need to be the gatekeepers of that culture, not doing their own thing because it's suddenly become about them. And then once we get to that stage where we've got an effective culture, we've got effective things going on, we've got the coaches behaving in a way that backs up those cultures, not just by what they say, but actually how they behave on a regular basis in training and on match days. And then we can then start engaging the parents, because a lot of the parent angst comes through shock or seeing something that they don't expect to see, or seeing something that contradicts maybe what they've been told. And I know I've said this to you before about the coach behaviour piece, that, you know, if we've got coaches running up and down the side of the field shouting at officials, and we've got coaches running up and down joystick instructioning players, then for me, you have given carte blanche for the parents behind you to follow suit. Because you are sending out such mixed messages, and it's this lack of clarity and this lack of sort of communication about what it should look like and why that is missing. You know, I've got coaches in this country who are doing some great work, and they come to me and say, do you know what? I'm a lot quieter on the sidelines now. It's really, really good. But now I've had a parent come up to me saying that I lack passion and I don't care. Which is amazing. So we've got some coaches who are doing the right things and now being criticised for that. Now, we then, as either as a sports organisation or the work that we do with parents, have to explain that is good coaching, because parents don't know what good coaching is. And we need to explain why coaches aren't yelling 5 million instructions every 2 minutes. And we need to explain to them that they're giving the freedom for players to express themselves, make their own decisions, adding feedback at the right times. But that's what it looks like, and it's okay. Don't panic. Just because, you know, something's gone wrong and the coach hasn't started shouting and ranting or trying to correct it, you know, we need to let parents know that it's okay for their children to fail. And the coach's job isn't necessarily to pick them up at that stage. It might be to pick them up the following training session. It might be to pick them up after the game, because children have got to go through those moments of failure. The difficulty is parents don't like to see it. And that's the tough bit. But if we're all doing the same thing and that they get used to seeing it, then, you know, a bit like the winning and losing piece, it's not that big a deal, because we've learned how to cope with it.
Yeah, I mean, basically, in a nutshell, and I've been a big advocate for this for years, the coaches are the catalyst for change, because they're interacting with the players, the parents, the board members, the officials. So all the stakeholders go through the coaches. So if the coach is not setting the example, others will follow suit of how they're. And, you know, I remember there was a game that I was coaching years back, and one of my players, because I was challenging a referee about a serious hit from behind where one of my players was really hurt. And the player says to me, "Hey coach, calm down, serenity now." And like, we get emotional as coaches, but very rarely did I actually say much during games, because the game itself is for the kids. That's their cherry time. That's their reward for all the hard work they did in the training sessions or practices. And really, they're not developing in those games, because they rarely touch the ball or the puck or whatever the case may be. It's in the training session. So that's the communication from a coach perspective. Say, hey, please be quiet during the games. And if the coach is, you know, kind of observing and just letting them do what they should be doing, you nail on the head in terms of lack of decision making. The whole robotic joystick concept, yeah. If they're not making decisions on their own, they're never going to become creative. They're never going to develop their skill set in a game environment, because they're being told what to do. Well, yeah, no wonder so many of them are saying, hey, I don't want to play this anymore, because I don't have the opportunity to try things and make mistakes without fear.
Yeah, absolutely. And you've hit the nail on the head with that point, that coaches have such a key role to play. I'm actually in the middle of a blog on that as we speak, on it's called Setting the Tone and Watching Parental Engagement Thrive. And it's very much aimed around that piece about how coaches can take the lead and can amazingly improve their environments by just doing a few things and being a bit more aware of it.
Mm-hmm. And not recognizing, yes, the emotions will come into play, but the key is to keep them in check so that the parents keep them in check.
Yeah, absolutely. And talk to parents and give them a voice so that we all know that it feels like that sometimes, and give them space to talk about the fact that there's going to be some pretty tough bits in there. And you know, we've got to be prepared for those tough bits, and, you know, what type of conversation you're going to have with your child afterwards when you've had those tough parts of the game. All really important, because, you know, some parents do it well, some parents need some support, and I think it's important that we give them that.
Yeah, that kind of precursor to the next question. Organizations that I've had a lot of dialogue with over the years are still struggling with the concept of incorporating budgets or training or education for parental support. The main emphasis that I've come across, and it doesn't matter what sport it is skill development, you know, hiring athletic directors, technical directors, paying them big bucks. Let's develop the skills of the players. But rarely have I had discussions with organizations that recognize the importance of ongoing coach mentoring and parental support. So it sounds like you've made some big inroads with several organizations. What led to them recognizing that there was a need and B, a benefit to providing that support to parents?
Yeah, I think people have always recognized there's certainly a need. I think there's been a bit of fear about how we actually attempt to go about it. I mean, one of the big drivers that, and I'm pleased you've said that, one of the big drivers for me, and you know this, is that how we have priced up our offering, for me, is an absolute no-brainer. That we can spend hundreds of dollars, hundreds of pounds on kit, but we can't resource £5 for every child and parent that ever enters into sport to give parents as much access to as much support as they need. Just doesn't make sense to me. So there's clearly hidden agendas here, and you know that's how we priced it up, because, you know, a lot of the subscription models around the world are a lot more than that. They cost a lot more per year. And I refused to do that. I wanted it to be accessible to everybody, so that everybody turned around and said, yeah, do you know what? That's not a lot of money. You know, we spend £15 on the tie-ups for our socks, but we can't afford £5 on making environments better. You know, I think people are aware there's a need. And I think it's whether or not you're prepared to do it. And I think it's nice that these big organizations that we work with, including governing bodies and big, you know, soccer franchises are sticking the necks up there and saying, actually, do you know what, we'll go for this and lead the way, and hopefully lots more will follow suit behind them.
Have there been any that you've worked with for since last year when we talked that you've come into this year and had feedback of the cause and effect, if it has improved the experience for the kids?
Yeah, look, it's at that stage now where you're sort of into the program. I think the organizations who are having the most success are the ones that have done everything, the ones that have done the resources, provided the platform. We then train, what I didn't mention earlier, is we're now training people within organizations to deliver the workshops. And those that have then got out and about and delivered those, along with the resources, are starting to see some positive results. I mean, look, you're probably going to take a couple of years to see the impact, you know, on a big scale. But I certainly know people that have attended workshops, coaches and parents have been, you know, very, very grateful that somebody's, you know, in some cases they say, oh, that's quite obvious, but we don't do it. I think that's sort of nice feedback when we've all recognised it, but it's almost been a bit like the elephant in the room that nobody's really wanted to go there. And we get lots of positive stuff back from workshops in particular. And I always say that as a coach or a parent, if we go to one of those workshops and we can take one or two small things away that's going to enhance the experience either for us as a coach or parent or for the children that we're involved with, then it's been worthwhile.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. And one of the questions I've added this year, and I'm just curious on your sense of it, I've shared this quote to everywhere I go, is kids play sports because they're fun. They quit because they're not. It's not rocket science. And then a lot of people say, okay, well, what is fun? Like, what do you use? Many kids, when you think, a lot of people joke around it, that is them goofing around. But if you talk to a kid, they actually don't want their teammates goofing off when they're practicing or playing games. They want them to be serious to a certain extent, but enjoy the experience. What's your definition of fun when it comes to sport?
Well, for me, it's a personalized thing, Glenn. I think we've just got to be aware as people in the sector that people's definitions of fun are very different. You know, every child is going to be different. Some would like to eat the hot dogs afterwards. Some would like to have a laugh with the mates and goof around. Some might actually be quite serious and really, you know, have huge aspirations to, you know, make it all the way to being professional. But, you know, as we always go back to Amanda Visek's work, you know, she's come up with 82 different ways of defining it. One of those will be, you know, what excites our child or the children that we're playing with, and everybody's different. And it was good talking to some people over here, because we've just got to be a little bit careful with the winning place or the fun data of this, because as children get a little bit older and they're in, particularly in their teenage years, and let's say they're involved in performance programs and they're having to give up, you know, social time or time at home, and they're training really, really hard, we can't really have a conversation with them where winning's not important, because I'll tell you what, if you ask the child, yes, it is. So it's not a blanket one size, you know, fits all. But I think as a starting point, we've got to understand that the winning and playing in tournament, where, as I've said to you before, is always a top five adult answer for why their children play. It probably isn't when you ask the child.
Yeah, well, and Amanda Visek, because you're a precursor to that, the bottom half, so winning was 48th out of 81 characteristics of what was fun. But where it gets interesting, and what I've been sharing with a lot of people, is the bottom third included playing in tournaments, traveling, trophies and medals, which is the participation trophy concept, and working with specialty trainers and coaches. Like, it's right near the bottom, which is the whole early sports specialization concept. And ironically, the last one, the dead last, 81 on the list, was getting their pictures taken. So that is for the parents, it's for the grandparents, the uncles, you know, for circulating the family. I don't know how many pictures I have in a big tub, because my mother kept them all in one place and I gave them my brother when she passed away. But, you know, we've got to kind of think that in perspective, that these are the least fun activities, but the most fun is when kids have an opportunity to try their best, when they have great coaches that treat them fairly, when they get to play, when they get along with their teammates, play well as a team. That's where the shift and the focus should be. But we've got a lot of work to do to kind of bring it back around to that sector. So fast forwarding, say, 3-5 years down the road, where do you see working with parents in sport? What are your objectives?
I would love to see all that, what I said earlier, maybe double or triple. So we're working with sort of, you know, 15 national governing bodies. I would love to see more, you know, soccer franchises. I would love to see more work, you know, all around the world with it. And I would like to see that it just become part and parcel of any parent or any child experience, that parents arrive into a sport, they are well resourced and well supported, they get given a good idea of what the sporting journey looks like or what the sporting environment should look like. I would love to see coaches creating amazing environments for children from a coaching perspective. That's just as somebody who coaches themselves, but then also be able to bring parents into that process. And as I say, I'd just like it to be, rather than it being a revolutionary thing, which it may be at the moment where it's quite new, I would just like to see it become, you know, standard practice, and then it would feel like all the hard work's been worthwhile.
No, I mean, I think it's going to happen. I think it's going to take time, but I'm seeing the needle shift in Canada. Are you seeing it shift in the UK, where we're kind of bringing it back to the kids?
Oh, yeah, without a doubt. I think definitely the last 12 to 18 months, there's far more open discussions and far more people sticking the head above the parapet and saying it how it is, rather than, you know, hiding behind their own organisations and not prepared to talk. And this is what we've always done. It's definitely more out there now, and I think there's a lot of good work going on from a lot of people. We should be encouraging, and look, and those people who are reluctant, or coaches who've always done it that way, you know, just be open-minded, you know, to be a to be a great coach, you've got to evolve, you've got to change. You know, society's changing, sports changing, the perception of sports changing. Children, you know, have changing to some extent. Parents have changed because society's forced that upon them. It's not because they've necessarily changed the fundamentals, but there's certain things that parents maybe do now that maybe a generation ago they didn't. And we've just got to sort of ride with it and make the best of it, knowing that ultimately we you know, sports just a wonderful thing, and for me is still the safest way of equipping children with lots and lots of life skills, and I just hope we give them the opportunity to do that well.
Yeah, I can agree with you more. I mean, one of my takeaways in all my talks is teach skills, and not just the skills of the game, but because that's what kids want to learn, is how to get better, but also skills of life. You think about concept, you know, values like respect and sportsmanship, winning with humility, losing with dignity. Those are sports skills, but leadership, communication, dealing with adversity, you know, being resilient, and simple things like being punctual, being on time. If you're not early, you're late, right? So there's so many life skills that then can transfer. But when kids are quitting too early, they're kind of losing out on those key development years. Like the first 5-6 years is, you know, motor skill development, but then the development, the social development happens later on. So one of the big challenges that we face here is keeping them in the game. So from a coach perspective, how important, and I've asked this for several people, I'm curious what your take is, certification in the UK is a little different than it is in Canada, a little different than it is in the US, but once the coaches do their initial certification, how important is it for them to continue to learn as coaches?
Yeah, look, this is always, I guess, not causes conflict, but there is a perception in the world, isn't there, that we've got to rely on volunteers in sport. Not everybody's paid for being involved in sport or for coaching sport. But I think we've also got to recognise that just because we're volunteering doesn't mean that we have to do it badly. And I don't mean that directly at the volunteers in any way. I'm actually having more of a hit there at the people who employ the volunteers or have them in, because actually we should be doing everything we can to support them to improve within the time constraints that they've got available, and do everything we can so that what they're delivering and the experience that they're delivering people is better. And I think there's some room for improvement in that. Now, if people are getting it, love their sport and are wanting to get into coaching, I would say to anybody, you should always be learning. I've probably done 3 full cycles in the last 20 years on what I believed was right, wrong, indifferent, come back to it, taken bits of it. It's a real mishmash. And if we're passionate about something and we're getting into coaching because we love sport, I think, as you say, I think we should be doing everything we can to be improving all the time. And there's plenty of stuff out there now if you're prepared to go and look and talk to people.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, lifelong learning, greatest coaches of all time, the John Woodens of the world, they were still taking pages of notes at conferences well after they retired because they may learn something, right? But trying to get grassroots coaches that are, I've had pushback as recent as a couple of weeks ago. Matt was showing the cost of winning at UBC, and I sat with 3 grassroots coaches, and 2 of them said, oh, you know, we just don't have time for any extra development, and it's too expensive. So number one, we got to make it as cost effective as possible, which you and I totally agree with. And secondly, make it easy for them to access. So whether it's online content or resources or, you know, bringing in experts, whatever the case may be. But I really believe that until we get the coaches really recognizing professional development is to help them become better, so the kids ultimately become better and creates a better quality experience. So
yeah, and we've got to say, we've got to find different methods, because again, just like anything, people learn in different ways. Some people have more time to attend things in the flesh. Some people have no time. Some people like to read. Some people like to watch video. I think that, again, it goes back to, there's not a one-size-fits-all. What we've got to make available is every different way of doing it, so that coaches have got no excuses to say, well, I haven't been able to do any of it.
Yeah, couldn't agree with you more. Interestingly enough, I talked to David Turner from UK Coaching for part of this event, and he shared with me, and I'm not sure if you've come across it, the LTAD model is still a work in progress, ironically, even though we developed in Canada many, many years ago with a lot of the national sport organizations, PSO, to trickle down. It's amazing how many coaches I still get in clinics when I ask the question, how many of you are familiar? Only a few hands go up. Physical literacy, it sounds like it's really well established now in the UK as it is in other countries. But what's your take on the new research? And I don't know if you've come across it, that the LTAD model is really relative to the strength that the participants have through the course of development. So they have to have the core strength to be able to do the motor skills. Agree?
Yeah. I mean, it's, look, I think it's funny because I'm half laughing at our good friend Wayne Goldsmith here, and I can still hear his words telling me that there's no such thing as a long-term athletic development model, because if they're not playing next week, it's a load of rubbish anyway. I don't believe that, but I can sort of see his method and his madness, that we're looking at the long-term picture, which we need to do, because we need to explain that sport is a long-term journey and we need to have the pillars in the right place at the right time. But we ultimately need to make sure that they're enjoying it and are engaged next week, otherwise they won't get on to the next stage. They've gone anyway. So I don't know how you want me to answer that, because while I'm trying to answer it, all I can hear is Wayne in his Aussie accent coming out like that. So I'm gonna quit on that question and let people make up their own mind, I think.
It's funny you say that, because when I talked to him last year, and he's brilliant, absolutely brilliant. We had a great conversation. Okay. But the one that I love, my most favorite quote, and I always give him credit for it, there is no such thing as an elite 6, 8, 10, 12-year-old. It's not part of my vocabulary, so please remove it from yours.
Absolutely.
And I think elite is the dirtiest word in sport, because a 6 or 7 year old kid, if they're showing good, you know, they're an early bloomer at best. And more often than not, those early bloomers get passed by the late bloomers later on, like 12, 13. All the science shows that like, if you're good at 6, 7, doesn't necessarily mean you're going to reach the pinnacle when you're 18.
That's all the signs are showing, right?
And I just wonder
what, you know, with those early bloomers and those people who show that success, you know, what role we've actually had as coaches and parents in them actually being overtaken. You know, because when you look at it, it's great if a child's really well developed at the age of 10 technically, and is you know, emotionally well developed and is doing all these things. Surely then there's just there the building blocks to go on. But what we tend to do as coaches is we give them far too much of an ego. We place too much emphasis on the outcomes of how many goals they've scored or how many times, or all these things. The parents give them all the credit, can't wait to tell another parent about it, slam it all over Facebook and whatever else. And then the moment that life becomes a bit tougher, all that sort of kudos and credibility that they were getting and praise on a regular basis from parents and coaches suddenly disappears. And it's like, actually, do you know what? I think I'll call this a day now. Mm-hmm. You know, so we're losing them that way as well. And I don't think there can be a negative about, you know, being a good 10-year-old. Surely we've got a good 10-year-old then. What we need to do is keep it in perspective and keep them going on the right journey. I just wonder if some of those we've slightly not helped ourselves as coaches and parents.
Yeah, and that's the whole money model as well, right? The last question before we do rapid fire, early specialization has been a hot topic and for years now. It seems to kind of be subsiding a little bit, but is it still a problem in the UK? And what are some organizations doing to reverse the trend so that kids are involved in multiple sports, which is the right path?
Yeah, look, I think there's an awareness. I think there's still an awful lot of people who believe the more you do, the better you'll be. And I still think there's an awful lot of people trying to tick the 10,000 hours off on the fridge to get there as quickly as we can, despite us all knowing that that's purely a myth and has no relation to the sports industry, you know, whatsoever. So, you know, as you say, specialisation is clearly not a good thing. It's nice to see, you know, I just read something from England Rugby again today saying that no children can be involved in any form of rugby practice over the next 2 months. Season's just finished here. I think people need to work together. It was interesting listening to something and talking to somebody last week about these amazing sports club models where wouldn't it be brilliant if we had one sports club and everybody got 3 months of the year each, but every child played all four and we all helped each other out and we all encouraged them to go and play the other three, rather than saying or selling this dream that, oh, no, if you want to be good, you've got to do 5 million hours by the time you're 10 and you've got to travel 5 million miles while you're at it. I mean, it's madness, isn't it? And I think the organisations have got to take the lead on that. If we know that, and the science is telling us that, and we know in the best interests of young people generally as a rule, then I think they've got to be saying, actually, do you know what? There isn't any of this available for the next 3 months. We've had our season.
Yeah, which is agreed in the concept for the NGB and or the provincial national sport organization, saying we're only going to support you in these seasons. But where the model has really got skewed is the private organizations that are kind of, you know, preying on the naive parentees and naivete when they've got a 5 or 6, 7 year old kid and say, hey, you know, he's got a lot of promise. He could go to NCAA or play professionally as long as he does X, Y, and Z and the year round. So curbing that is also going to be a challenge, but enforcing or trying to make sure that kids understand the benefits and we're starting to see it. I have talked to a couple of organizations for this event in particular. There's one in Ontario called Top Sports, and they are adamant of supporting all long-term athletic, great quality coaching, importance of fun, multi-sport participation, because all three of the founders not only played high-level hockey, but they were still playing 2 or 3 sports when they're in high school. Mm-hmm. So they know the benefits, and the reason why they became great hockey players is because of all the athleticism and the skills they learned through the other sports. So it's coming. I think it's going to take a while. We're, as a generation of kids that, unfortunately, like mine, and I think hopefully you catch yours before the tail end, but I can't change what happened for them, but hopefully we can change it for the future.
Yeah, I have a huge sympathy for parents on this, because I've said this to you before, and you know my son's involved in some, you know, high-performance soccer over here. And I've had to be massively brave for the last 4 seasons to say, do you know what? It's May. I'll see you all again in August. I've been looked at like, well, what are you doing? How can that be possible? I look at other thing, and then you see photos of other children playing and you doubt yourself. You're like, oh my goodness, I hope this isn't going to backfire on me. And then you turn up at the beginning of last season, and for the first 3 weeks, it looked like it was one of the worst decisions in the world. But by December, it was one of the best decisions in the world. But actually backing yourself and trusting it. And look, I've got a huge sports background and I have doubt about it and thinking, oh, should they be doing more? You know, what chance has a normal parent who's got none of that? And I'm really passionate about trying to get people to back themselves, back the science, you know, and be more supported to make better decisions.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, it's that doubt and also the pressure, the peer pressure that parents have from other parents, which you're experiencing, which I experience. Like, why is your son not doing this year round? Because our fear of keeping up with the Joneses, that's probably one of the biggest challenges. The other one, and it's my last question before some rapid fire, is the love. When the kid loves the sport and that's all they want to do, how do we overcome that with parents? What's your take when parents say that, but they love it?
It depends. I mean, my take on that is, if a child truly loves that and that's all they want to do, I don't believe they get that love at the age of 7. They might get it a bit later, because suddenly they've decided, hang on, I've tried 7 or 8 things and actually I just absolutely love this. Which case, maybe we have to manage their time and their season and make sure that if that is the only thing that they're doing, that there's plenty of recovery time. Because parents will always say to me, they'll always say to me, oh, he only likes football. Well, no, he doesn't, because what else have you given them a go at? Mm-hmm. And they'll stay there, oh, well, we haven't really tried it. I said, well, so how do you know that we only like one thing? And a lot of the time it's because that's the only thing they can maybe get to, which I get, you know, more difficult. Maybe it's the only thing that they love as parents. So as a result, that you know, they've put that onto their children. But I genuinely don't believe if you give children 3 or 4 different sports or give them the experience of trying different ones, that they would suddenly say, that is the only one I want to do. And if they do say that, I think they'll say it much later on. If you're a parent listening to this, or your coach listening to this, and a parent's come to you and said that, what I would say then is please make sure that they're having 3 months a year off. If that's the only thing they're doing, okay, don't let them play any other, if they don't want to play any other sport, but let them have 3 months playing at the beach or doing something completely different, you know, because otherwise, as you say, it's going to be the road to ruin, isn't it, injury-wise and burnout, no matter how much they love it, because bodies just won't cope with it.
Yeah, and it basically answers the question that they will not love the game more at the end of the season than they did at the beginning. Eventually, that's going to – and I saw that firsthand, and I've seen it with a lot of kids where that smile starts eroding 11, 12, 13 because they are going at it too much. So it's time to take that break in 3 months. It at least is 3 months. I'd love for it to be longer and then try another seasonal sport so that they can develop other skills. But you know, we got to cross that bridge one step at a time. So
some
rapid fire question before we finish up. Your two pocketbooks are absolutely brilliant, and they're available in a hard copy format. They're also available ebook. Are there any other resources that you're recommending to augment those, or is it going to the deep dive in the website where you have a whole peripheral of other resources for people to access?
Yeah, I mean, look, I do lots of reading like you do around the internet, some of the things that you put out on social media every day. You know, I encourage people to gain access to as much information as they possibly can. I think one of the strengths of the work we do on the website is we've tried to turn a lot of the science into manageable information for people. You know, I'm not going to stand there. We have research papers on the site, but I'm not going to send a normal sports parent to start digging into scientific papers. I don't believe that's right. We will try and put that information, you know, into a context that people can understand. And I think there's some, as you said, I think there's some really good coaching work out there. I think there's some really good parents work out there. So just have a dig around and just check your sources a little bit. Just make sure that the reputable businesses, I guess.
Yeah, there's integrity, and they actually are giving you the right advice instead of trying to steer you in a direction that may or may not be in the best interest of your kids. Last question: what can coaches do to shave 5 years off their learning curves? Ones that are just getting started.
I think be prepared to fail. Know that sometimes it's going to be difficult. Always be prepared to learn. There's always something out there. Try things. I always say to young coaches now, try things. Because the number of teams that I used as guinea pigs along the way, and some of these ended up winning national titles. So it really wasn't a bad thing. Tried things, didn't work. Bin them, kick them out, regardless of whether they might work for somebody else, they may not work for you. But you know, be prepared to give it a go. Doesn't quite work out, adapt it and improve. And if you keep doing that, you will end up with a really good bank of resource, activity, things that you know work, that your players enjoy, that you enjoy delivering, that end up achieving the results that you want.
Okay, last question. How important is it for coaches to have a mentor and to reflect on their season so that they can improve the following year?
I think it's absolutely invaluable. I was very lucky in the early stages of my coaching. I was surrounded by 10 to 12 really top coaches in my field, and there was always people to go and talk to. There was people who'd watch something. There was always people I could go and watch and learn from. If we felt slightly out of line and they disagreed, they would tell you. They would pull you up on why you'd done it and question it. Absolutely invaluable, because without that and without people who've been there and have seen all these things, like we're able to talk now, you know, without that level of experience, you know, life is far trickier. So yeah, absolutely vital. And not, it doesn't even need to necessarily be a mentor in so much of name. Just find people you can go and watch and people you can talk to and share the experience with.
Yeah, I can agree with you more. My mentorship was with one of the most amazing coaches that I ever met, as well as a whole bunch of other ones, but who coached my daughter in softball, and I helped coach that team for a number of years. It's amazing how many tidbits and nuggets he would share with me when the girls were warming up for practices, and it could be totally unrelated to softball. It was just from a coaching standpoint and the importance, because it also coaching girls versus boys was completely different than, and a lot of people don't realize that there's dynamics that you have to deal with. So mentorship for me is really, really important. Yeah. And without it, you're kind of spinning your wheels and like, how do I learn? How do I get better? What can I do? And especially run into challenges like, you know, I've got this problem child on my team. Like, what do I do with that and stuff like that? So that was amazing. Like anytime we get on one of these calls, I'm just like, oh, you know, we could probably do this for like hours and hours and end, but I know you've got your presser time, and I really appreciate you doing this. So how do people find the great work that you're doing?
Yeah, so visit us at www.parentsinsport.co.uk. You can email me, gordon@wwpis.co.uk. I reply personally to every email, and I get lots of parents who email me. And please check us out on Twitter and Facebook, because I think that the more people who read the type of positive messages we're trying to get across, even if not everybody agrees with everything that you're saying, for me, the fact that it's starting conversation and people may take it somewhere else and start a discussion is equally as important.
Now, and the big key there is not complaining about the problems, but being part of the solution, which I applaud you for all the great work that you've done this past year. And I suspect that you're going to continue to explode not only in your side of the pond, but as we continue to work together to see what happens in North America and other markets. So it was a great chat. Yeah. I enjoyed it.
Well, let's hope so. Let's just keep working hard. And they say if you keep working hard, you'll get there in the end.
Yeah, touche. Thanks for joining us this week. You can find us on Facebook, For Love of the Game, Twitter, and forlovethegame.ca. We'll see you next week for an all-new episode.